think Tevez going to Juventus, what a coup that was for me. I mean,
on a head-to-head battle, Atletico Madrid can do more damage to Barcelona than the other way around.
Either he's really blind or he's fixing the match. I can't see it any other way.
I'm trying to get Sir Bob on my side here by saying City will win the Premier League.
It is an upset. You would expect Man United to go and win there.
Over $1 billion was paid in transfer fees between the clubs in Europe.
It's football. It's damn football. Like Ferguson said, football. Bloody marvellous.
Yeah, well, the celebration was, I can't believe I just scored against Mexico.
At one point, Parma, I think it's only like 224 players under contract.
So they're going to throw me out of here, fellas. You're going to get me arrested on your show.
If you're a serious talent, you're going back and you're playing for Santos. You know, you're going back to play for, like in Argentina, for River Plate or Boca Juniors. Or you're going to Europe.
He looked like the Ryan Giggs of old. He was more creative than any player on the pitch. He made Mata look stupid. He made Rooney look silly.
Now, the Premier League is the most exciting league out there. I think it's probably the best marketed league without a question.
When you look at the draw for the Champions League, you kind of say, well, all the pieces kind of fell into place for everybody except City.
I am your host, Joe Uccello.
Sir Bob, Mike Orr. My co-host, Rob Rojas.
My trusted co-host, Ben the Machine.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 238 of Low Limit Football on this 24th of March, 2019, on the Beyond the Pitch and FNX Media Networks. I am your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight we're going to talk about Lionel Messi as he returns to the Argentinian national team against Venezuela. It was a memorable match, but not in the way he would want it. The number 10 jersey switches hands in both Italy and Brazil. We're going to tell you who got the heavy jersey and how they did on the weekend. England has a massive start to the European qualifying campaign as Raheem Sterling scores a hat trick in a 5-0 victory against the Czech Republic. And what is wrong with Atlanta United, now winless in their first three matches, and Joseph Martinez is way off his 2018 pace? We're going to discuss that and much, much more with football writer Chris Hennage, who will be joining us in just a bit. But let me get my co-host in here, Mr. Roberto Rojas. It was cold in New Jersey, wasn't it?
It was cold overall. I mean, isn't it supposed to be spring, Joe? I mean, didn't the groundhog tell us it was supposed to be spring much, much earlier?
You know, these are the moments where I think they should take the groundhog out back and shoot it. I mean, you know, and trust me, I'm so mad.
Like Old Yeller, is that it?
No, Old Yeller was sad. This wouldn't be sad. So what my wonderful co-host is referring to is that we were both press credentialed for the Paraguay-Peru match. Rob, you spent most of the week in New Jersey following the Paraguay national team, and I was going to join you on Friday night, but with what ended up being a freak snowstorm here in the Northeast, I ended up staying home and catching just highlights and blips of the match as I could, and you were able to cover the game and do all the things that I was hoping to do. And not only that, like I'd mentioned to you earlier, one of the main things I wanted to see in that match was Christian Cueva play, because he plays in Brazil. We don't get to see him that much, only really at this national team time. And he's one of my favorite players, one of the most exciting players out there. And here was an opportunity to see him play live. And I did not get to go and see him play live. And not only does he play well, he scores the only goal in a 1-0 victory for Peru over Paraguay, totally ruining my Friday night, you know, making the collapse of my Friday night complete, I would say, Rob. But, you know, let's move on from that, because the pain is real and I'm sick of it. So let's do some trivia real quick, right?
Let's
get our trivia question in here and then we'll get into opening thoughts. So yesterday, Italy starts out their 2019. This is the trivia question. Italy started their 2019 European campaign with a 2-0 victory over Finland at home. Goal scorer Moise Kean became the second youngest goal scorer in the history of the Italian national team at 19 years and 23 days. Can you tell me who the youngest was?
And he scored a great goal as well. It's been a wonderful, I would say, month for Moise Kean right now.
You think the brace he scored in the Serie A, he gets a play in Champions League. He gets called up to the national team, starts for the national team, scores a goal for the national team in a meaningful game. This was not a friendly, and just really finally getting his chance to blossom, and he's doing it and really giving a lot of people hope. I mean, we saw Federico Bernardeschi also have a great match against Finland yesterday. He was one of the number 10s that I alluded to in the monologue, the opening monologue. The other one was Brazilian. Normally that number 10 jersey is reserved for Neymar, but with him being out injured, Lucas Paqueta, the midfielder that's playing over at AC Milan, got to wear the number 10. I didn't get a chance to see his performance, Rob, but by all accounts, it wasn't the greatest, but it wasn't bad.
It was a 1-1 draw, but it wasn't exactly the best Brazil performance.
Exactly. So,
but good to see Paqueta and Keane scoring as well. You know, they're on good form for their team. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Joe, and obviously I'll think about the trivia question, the answer in a bit. But you know, should they keep Moises Keane? Should Juve keep him?
Absolutely.
So don't send him on loan for next season.
No. In fact, you start to wonder about Mario Mandzukic's durability at this point, right? I mean, he's been. You know, he's been a warrior for Juve and for the Croatian national team now for quite some time. And I think that's starting to wear on him a little bit. We haven't seen him perform as well as he usually does this latter point of the season here, both in Champions League and in the Serie A. You know, part of that is also the weight that Cristiano Ronaldo carries. But I think we've seen a little bit of a step off from Mandzukic. And the man's a warrior, so he's not going to give up, right? But I think you can see that his time is limited in terms of what he can and can't do. And I feel like Moise Kane is now he's getting his opportunity and he's really taking it. And I think that's going to be enough for Allegri, or if they get rid of Allegri, that whoever the next coach is, to really say, yeah, he needs to stay here because he's going to get meaningful minutes moving forward with this side. So I don't think you send him on.
And I think if Juve do get rid of him, they're going to regret it completely.
I agree. Oh yeah, if they sell him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh God, yeah, that'd be massive. It'll be Zaniolo. You know, it'll be the Zaniolo move where Inter, you know, gets rid of Zaniolo and all of a sudden they're like, oh man, we messed up. You know, it'll be one of those. And I think the kid's a star. I think the kid's a star. He's 19 years old. He's going to get better. You know, are we going to start putting him up there as one of the top strikers in the world? No, he's got a hell of a lot more to prove. This is super flash in the pan time, right? But right. I think if he develops some consistency, and obviously that'll come with time, with playing, and I think you're going to see him more in the Serie A now that they've pretty much won the Serie A. Those matches are, for all intents and purposes, meaningless for Juve other than to tune up for the Champions League. I think you will see more of him. I think he's going to get more playing time. He's going to get his opportunity to blossom, and that is going to be massive for him. I think it's going to be massive for Juve, and it'll be massive for the national team as well. So, all right, let's. So I've given you the trivia question. Moise Keane yesterday scores a goal for the Italian national team. 19 years, 23 days old, second youngest goal scorer for the Italian national team ever. Who was the first? Who's the youngest person to ever score a goal for the Italian national team? And we'll give you the answer at the end of the show. So let's jump into our opening thoughts tonight. And our opening thoughts is a great one. France Football came out this week and ranked the top 50 managers of all time. I'm going to run down from number 10 on the list. You can find this in multiple outlets. I'm going to be using goal.com and their list. I think it's a nice comprehensive list with a little description because some of these coaches, many might not have heard of. So let's go in from number 10, Bill Shankly, the former Liverpool manager. Number 9, Ernest Happel, who coached the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, among others. Number 8, Carlo Ancelotti, currently at Napoli. Number 7, Helenio Herrera, who was a coach at Atletico Madrid, Barcelona. He also won Serie A titles with Inter. Number 6, Valery Lobanovsky, who was the coach in the Ukrainian national team and the USSR national team as well. Number 5, Pep Guardiola, currently Manchester City, also of Barcelona and Bayern Munich fame. Number 4, Johan Cruyff, who coached at Ajax, coached at Barcelona, and really was an advancer of the total football philosophy. Arrigo Sacchi, number 3, won Serie A titles with Milan and then also won the European Cups with Milan as well. Number 2, Sir Alex Ferguson, legendary Manchester United head coach. And number 1, Rinus Michels. Michels is credited with inventing total football at Ajax in the 70s. Won European Cups with Ajax. He won La Liga with Barcelona. He won the European Championships with the Netherlands in 1988. To my recollection, the only international title that the Dutch have at the top level. So legendary coach there as well. That's our top 10. Rob, I want to get your thoughts on the top 10 first, or even the top 50 overall. What were some of the things you noticed?
Yeah, I mean, some of the things I've noticed is that you look at that top five and you look at how all of those managers have eventually reinvented the way we see the game. Michel, as you said, you know, was a proponent of total football, essentially inventing it, where you have all these players playing multiple positions, and that led them to success and other teams to follow into kind of similar paths. Mm-hmm. Alex Ferguson, obviously a manager who essentially changed, I think, the whole landscape of English football from the 90s and onwards, you know, essentially changed that landscape. Arrigo Sacchi, you know, a proponent of defense, and, you know, obviously a manager that was so successful at Milan in the late 80s, early 90s, widely regarded as one of the greatest teams of all time. Mm-hmm. Johan Cruyff, as great as a player that he was also a great manager, obviously kind of a successor of Michel's, but also a predecessor to the guy who's in fifth place, and Pep Guardiola, and, you know, obviously proponent of total football advancing, and didn't even get that little bit of influence of tiki-taka, which Guardiola was. Obviously so successful at the multiple clubs that he was at in Barcelona, Bayern Munich, and now Manchester City. So I think with that top five, you could obviously argue that they speak for itself. Obviously all five have won European Cups with their respective clubs. Ancelotti, I think, is a little bit harsh. Obviously Herrera and Lewandowski changed the landscape as well of their game. But I think on titles alone, Ancelotti should be perhaps a bit higher. Some of the people that do miss out of the top 10, I mean, I'm looking at the list right now. Obviously, Mourinho is at 13th, obviously, you know, successful in his own help. Brian Clough, a really, I would say, controversial manager during his time in England, but obviously still very successful. Louis van Gaal, 18th. Fabio Capello at 21. This one is an interesting one because I look at the whole list and then I look at who's at the bottom. On titles alone, I think it makes sense. But when you look at the people that are below him, it becomes a bit questionable. And that's Zinedine Zidane at 22. Above coaches like Jupp Heynckes, Jurgen Klopp, Gus Hiddink, Diego Simeone, Arsene Wenger, Vicente del Bosque at 33, won multiple Champions League and the World Cup and the Euro with Spain and Real Madrid, respectively. He's only at 33, which I think is a bit harsh on France football in itself. I think he deserves a much, much higher importance because of titles won. Tele Santana, obviously, the head manager of that great 82 squad for Brazil. Marcelo Bielsa makes a mention at 48. So there are a few controversial picks. I think Jurgen Klopp as well at 27th is kind of a bit different considering he didn't win anything major in Europe, at least did obviously win the Bundesliga as a part of this good Liverpool side that didn't win anything yet, but it's still a bit controversial. I think I could agree with the top five. I think going below that, it's a big debate for anyone at this point.
I agree with you completely. The one thing for me, the glaring one, and you mentioned his name, for me, that calling it harsh is, I think, is being kind. I thought it was farcical. And that's Vicente Del Bosque at 33. The man has won not only, and for me, this is a measure of greatness for me, is the fact that the man has won both in La Liga, right, as a, yep, you know, as a coach there, and then he won the European Championships and the World Cup. Now, right, granted, he's the man at the helm of a golden generation to rival all golden generations of world football with that Spanish national team. I get that part. And you know, you could almost have a three-legged monkey coaching that side and you would probably win something. They were that good. But the man, you know, one of the things that when a team is that good, there's a lot of egos, and it takes something to manage the team. It takes something to manage them tactically. It takes something to manage them mentally. And this man had it, because this team, you know, you think about the Spanish national team, they won, if I remember correctly, two straight Euros.
Yep.
And they won the World Cup in the middle. This was the dominant team in world football for a decade. It is not debatable. They won every competition. And this is the man that is widely associated with being at the helm for that team in those dominant years. And to have him at 33, I think, is a joke. Right. I think this man should have been in the top 10. I do agree, Zidane, you know, this is one of the things, some of the guys like Zidane, Pep Guardiola, their book of business is not complete.
Their story. You can mention right. Ancelotti, Mourinho, I think Klopp as well, Simeone. Mm. Those type of managers, they're not done yet.
Right.
So now we don't know what they can do.
Ancelotti, I think, is somebody that should be put onto this list because I think his book is almost finished. Right. I don't think Ancelotti is going to be around that much longer to coach that many more teams. But guys like Arsene Wenger definitely belong in this list. And I think, you know, I think the knock on Wenger at 32 is going to be the fact that he, you know, they won the Premier League and won the FA Cup. He didn't win outside of Europe. You know, he kind of did it at one spot, but it also speaks to his longevity. That he was able to stay there in 22 years at Arsenal, which is an amazing accomplishment. And I know many people want to remember the final 2 or 3 years of Arsene Wenger, but tend to forget the invincible years and all of those years where they were a dominant side in England.
And essentially changing, I think, the way essentially English football was seen. You know, he changed the way diets have been made, you know, training. So he's really an innovator more than anything.
Absolutely.
And I think that's where you look at this list. I think that's why you have to combine everything. You look at results, yes, that makes sense. You look at trophies won. You also look at philosophy, the way teams played, how they changed the landscape of the game. That's where all those factors get played into one, and that's where you have to be decisive and where people have more of an advantage over others.
Exactly. Now, a couple of things here, you know, in regards to the top five, the one thing that I would recognize is that the guys in the top five, Guardiola, Johan Cruyff, Arrigo Sacchi, Alex Ferguson, and Rinus Michels, They kind of transformed football, and you think about Guardiola as kind of an offshoot of Cruyff, right? With tiki taka and everything. So, I think Cruyff maybe belongs a little higher up the list because of his coaching tree. Okay, the people that he has influenced, the coaches that he's influenced in his career that are also on this list. I think is a credit to him. You know, I think with Alex Ferguson, the world, you know, the European domination, the EPL domination, I think is legendary. And I think he belongs in the top five. I don't want to change the top five per se. If anything, Rob, I would say maybe take Guardiola out because, again, his book is not complete. And Guardiola at five might actually be doing him a disservice. You know, if you think about it, we might be doing him an injustice because he might be better than five. He could be one, right?
He could be. It's still easy, and he's still in the, it would say, early stage of his coaching career. He's been a coach for like what, maybe a decade or so, and he's 48 years old.
Yeah.
Who knows what he could achieve in 10, 20 years' time?
Long time to still go on this path for him. So I, you know, I'm not arguing that he shouldn't be in the top five. I'm arguing that he might be too low. But we won't know. We might have to have this discussion, you and I, in 15 years, Rob, and then sit there and say, yeah, he is. You know. He is number one, or what were we thinking putting him at number five? He was he benefited from all those other things that happened for him. And when he really ended up with a team that had to struggle, he was terrible and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I just think that his book of business is not complete yet. It's definitely something that is worth discussing. And I think once you start to get into those 15s and 20s, I think you start to see the omissions, you start to see the issues with everything, you know, in terms of the list. So I think at that point, you know, it's a fun list to talk about, but you know, I think they got it pretty close.
I think they do.
Yeah.
I think they do as well.
Let's scrap but let's come off of our discussion there and let's add our guest into the show. I'm very excited to have him back because it's been quite some time since we've had the chance to talk to him and I'm super excited. Freelance football writer, you've seen him on multiple outlets and he's been on the show with us before, but now finally back after a few years, Mr. Chris Hennage. Chris, welcome back to the show, man. How have you been?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Fantastic. First of all, congratulations on your engagement.
Thank you very much.
I know we're slightly late on it, but glad to see that happen for you. And I want to jump into it, man. Let's talk about MLS real quick because I want to start out with Atlanta United. Obviously, and I know we've talked about them at length here on the show over the past few weeks, but they bear watching some more. They're currently sitting near the bottom of the table in the Eastern Conference. This is the you know. a championship side that had one of the most amazing seasons in the history of MLS, albeit a short history, 21 years, but still an amazing accomplishment. Joseph Martinez with the goal-scoring record. You saw so many great things out of this team. Now they move Miguel Almirón on, and of course they replace him with Piti Martinez, who got called up to the Argentinian national side. They've moved on with Tata Martino. They now have got Frank De Boer at the helm. And this team just looks a mess comparatively. They've only scored two goals so far on the season, Ezequiel Barco and Joseph Martinez, one each. And then after that, they've really had nothing to speak about. So what needs to be fixed in the short term at Atlanta United that can get them focused and back on the right path?
It's a great question. I think, realistically, the shift needs to be less dramatic. I think that's the problem. We look at, say, the Columbus Crew, for example, and I did a piece for Odds Checker on this week, just before Columbus were hammered 3-0, so that my timing is flawless on that one. Essentially talking about how the transition from Greg Berhalter to Caleb Porter is smoother because you're not shifting the dial that much. There are small tweaks that the players can still get on board with, whereas you look at what Tata did for 2 years with Atlanta. It was fast. It was aggressive. It was actually quite pragmatic at times as well, especially when it got to the playoffs. I don't see that with Frank. I think Frank is someone who's a lot more dogmatic. He's someone that looks at this 3-4-3 that he's been trying to implement now across two different jobs with Crystal Palace as well. And it just doesn't seem to work. I think it's one of those ideas that it probably looks great on paper and works even during training sessions and friendlies. But I think for this Atlanta team specifically, it just doesn't work. And that was kind of the problem he had at Crystal Palace as well, is that the players at his disposal weren't really suited to the formation and the style that he wanted to play. And some of that has to fall on Palace for not giving him players that were better suited to that. But at the same time, the situations really do mirror each other, because that was an instance where you were never going to make such a drastic change in a short space of time. And he almost refused to accept that, Frank De Boer. And I think there's a slightly similar scenario going on here. The benefit, or the positive, I guess, for him is this is a long season, and all he has to do in theory is make the playoffs for it to be considered a sustainable position for him to hold. I don't think it will get better anytime soon. Personally, I think it's going to be a pretty rough season for Atlanta, and that's unfortunate, because I think, yeah, they've exploded onto things, and it's not that it's this situation with Frank is not a case of them misstepping due to the lack of ambition. I think if anything, that's almost kind of the problem, is that they've tried to be so ambitious in getting him, they've not really thought about, well, how is this going to change the way we operate as a football club?
Right. I want to ask you a follow-up question, and it's kind of off the beaten path a little bit, because we saw a couple of coaching changes in MLS from last season to this season, and most notably, you saw Greg Berhalter leave Columbus Crew to go on to the U.S. men's national team, and you saw Tata Martino, who we just talked about, leave Atlanta United to go on to coach the Mexican national team. I know that Rob and I have made much about the decision to go with Berhalter over Tata Martino at the U.S. Federation. And we looked at the results on the weekend that Rob and I will dig into a little later on. But in your opinion, knowing what you've seen out of both coaches in MLS for whatever the time frame is, did the U.S. Soccer Federation make the right decision with Berhalter, or should they have kind of thrown their Spanish, you know, English only or English speaking rule and gone to Tata Martino instead?
That's a good question. I think it's difficult, because I do respect and admire a lot of what Greg has done. And I think as chance shy and goal shy as that game against Ecuador was, it was great to see, and it has been great to see, a US team that clearly has very nuanced tactical roles that all relate to each other and play a bigger picture. I think that's something that's been missing, certainly under Bruce Arena. Also, I would say under Klinsmann. I can't really speak to Bob Bradley on that one. What I would say frustrates maybe and surprises me more so about the US is, having been in that country for a little bit of time, the complex makeup of people and languages, I don't think it's acceptable simply to say that you have to speak English fluently to be the national team coach. I think if you're going to say that, you have to caveat with, and also Spanish, because actually, if you look, Spanish is increasingly a more popular and common language in the US. And I think what disappoints me is that they would rule someone like Tata out just for that. When you see what he's achieved with Atlanta United, when you see where he's been, what he did with Argentina. I mean, you can spin the Argentina one a few ways. They're either the great never was, or they're a team that reached a number of finals under his stewardship. So I think it would have been nice to see Tata come in and maybe enact a sort of long-term strategy. But I don't think there's any great shame in Greg coming in, because I think he's actually got ideas and he's got a plan to move the team forward in the long run. And a lot of his call-ups as well, I think, have been really quite exciting. People like Jonathan Lewis, he's not someone that's simply picking off who's at the top of the stat sheet domestically and in their leagues. He's looking at players and saying, okay, this is someone that can fit what I want to do. I think if there's one thing in totality that you draw away from it, is that it was just a horribly organized process from start to finish.
Oh, couldn't agree with you more on that one. It was mind-boggling how poorly the process was gone through, but we are certainly at this point, and I do agree. Greg does have the benefit of having been in the league for so long that, especially with the domestic players, gets to kind of pick off and kind of look at players that he thinks fits what he wants to do stylish-wise, and then go ahead and execute. So I do want to ask one more question coaching-wise before I throw it over to Rob. And I wanted to start off by asking if you had seen the France football 50 managers of all time that Rob and I were just discussing a few minutes ago.
I had seen mention of it, but not gone through the list in detail.
All right. Yeah, we were talking about it. And for me, I think they had Vicente Del Bosque at, I believe, 33 when we were talking about it. And I just thought that 33 for a man that accomplished so much was rather low. Regardless of who's on this list, do you think Del Bosque would have warranted or is one of the better managers we've seen, let's say, within the past 15 years of managing?
Yeah, I would say so. I think, look, he did an impressive thing with Spain at the World Cup. You know, that team, I think the longer time passes, I can't really decide if we'll have a stronger or a fainter memory of kind of how exciting they were or weren't. I wasn't blown away with them in that tournament. They were quite functional in terms of, they didn't score many goals, but they won, and you know, they dominated at the same time, which you have to admire. I also have to admit that a lot of his success is kind of just marginally before my time in terms of being able to evaluate and all that stuff. But I think you look at what he's achieved, you can't deny that he's been a fantastic coach.
You know, obviously, Chris, I'm going to jump in and shift gears more into England now and talk about your beloved Newcastle. Obviously, it's been quite a roller coaster ride, I would say, of the season so far that Rafa Benitez has been under the helm for. But, you know, obviously, the mention I want to talk about is Miguel Almirón, obviously, a player who's come in and really, I think, changed the shift of how Newcastle has been able to play, you know. I think they've won 3 games, drawn 2, and only lost 1 ever since his debut against Wolverhampton back on last month. So just from your basis and obviously being there, what are your impressions of how Miguel Almirón has been doing, especially to the, I guess, disgust of how Atlanta has been faring so far this season?
Yeah, I think that's the interesting comparison, the duality between Atlanta's struggles and Newcastle picking up, because they didn't have a great first half of the season. And I think the thing for Miguel was there was going to be a lot of pressure on him just because Newcastle don't spend a lot of money historically. And he was breaking their transfer record. And he was coming from a league that doesn't have the greatest standing among a lot of European watchers. But I think what he has done, when you sort of strip away any talk about goals and assists, is he's given them exactly what they've missed and what they've needed this season, which is someone that can run in behind, first and foremost, which I think we've seen a number of occasions. The one that jumps out to me is that Huddersfield game where he hits the post. And then also someone that's got a little bit of creativity and a bit of spark about them, because I think those three amigos, that the nickname they've sort of garnered now, Miguel, Solomon Rondon, and Iwasa Perez, they do kind of just harmonize perfectly, because you have Iosa who can sort of summon things, is a bit of a finisher, a bit of a poacher. Then you've got Solomon Rondon, who's this big target man that takes up two center backs. And then you've got Miguel floating around, picking up spaces, looking to have quick combinations. And I think that's where, at least with Miguel and Rondon, it works so well, because you really have to sort of pick your poison with Miguel. Either you drop 15 yards so he can't run in behind, which is exactly what Rondon wants, because he wants to be as close to the goal as possible. Or you push up to try and keep Rondon out of the box, in which case they're going to be looking for those balls over the top for Miguel. So I think it's worked really well so far, and I'm actually quite surprised by how quickly he's taken just to the league and the situation. I think that's a testament to him and his professionalism, if nothing else.
Definitely. It's been quite an interesting ride, I would say, and hopefully that he could finish off the season well, and that next season where, you know, he gets that full 38-game season, he could really demonstrate his potential, and then hopefully could help Newcastle achieve something great. But looking at the top of the table, obviously we have a big race happening between Liverpool and Manchester City. One of the arguments that I've been giving it with Joe over the last few weeks is kind of the similar schedule that both the teams are having to face, similar in the way of opponents. I think Liverpool have to, you know, take against Spurs, Chelsea, and Newcastle as well for their last remaining games of the season, whereas Manchester City have the Manchester Derby. I believe they also play Chelsea, if I'm not mistaken. Sorry, they play Spurs. And obviously having that in the Champions League. So both of them are in the Champions League as well. So where do you see this race coming about? And, you know, who do you think has more of the advantage, considering the similar situations that both the teams are in?
It's interesting. I would say that if you were to look purely at fixtures, you would say maybe the advantage is in Liverpool's hands. Obviously, City have got that game in hand that if they win, they go back to being a point on top. I see also a lot of people pointing to the Manchester Derby, the game at Tottenham. I think it's a little bit of a red herring that, because if you look at Manchester City this season, they haven't necessarily stumbled against those top teams that want to sort of play in a somewhat similar way to them. They've tended to slip up at places like Crystal Palace, where, you know, they came to the Etihad, beat them quite convincingly. And then again at Newcastle, they came up against a team that wasn't a deep block so much as it was a team that didn't want to give them space. And then when they felt the tide changing, was quite willing to press them. I think that's one of the things that I would possibly like to see more teams try with City, is to engage them and press them. I think if you're reckless with it, absolutely, you're going to be made to look quite stupid. But I do think City can be a bit susceptible to pressure. And I think that's why I look at the fact that they've still got Palace to play at Selhurst Park before the end of the season as a possible game that could cause them trouble, because Palace really are set up to cause Man City a lot of problems. And even in the 100-point season, you know, when they were desperately trying to avoid that first defeat that would eventually come against Liverpool, they went to Selhurst Park, and I think it was but for a penalty save fairly late in the game, they would have lost that game as well. So I think maybe Man City fans might call them a bogey team, I'm not sure, but I think there's certainly something about Palace that just does not work well for Man City when it comes to coming up against them. And I think if I'm looking for a game that will cause them trouble, it's possibly going to be that one. I mean, it comes just after that Tottenham game in the Champions League. So it's going to be travelling to London, I would imagine on a Sunday possibly. But you're going to be, either way, you're going to be probably staying in London. So you'll be travelling down there at some point, trying to acclimatise, trying to get used to it. And it's not perfect for City at all.
No, absolutely. Now, looking at the other teams in the Champions League, obviously Liverpool play Porto, Spurs and City play in that old English tie, and we have Manchester United taking on Barcelona. Obviously, it's been a fascinating season for English teams and in European competitions. We obviously have Arsenal and Chelsea in the Europa League as well. But, you know, looking at this all, is this the best chance that an English team could win the Champions League after 6 years, 7 years? You know, what do you think about all this? And, you know, do we see a potential English team in the final?
Absolutely. I think the number of teams that are still left in it suggests that. I think it's, for me, the Champions League has become quite cyclical. you look at sort of the ubiquitous presence of Bayern, Real Madrid, Barcelona, only one of them is still in it this season. That period of dominance came after the English teams thriving towards the end of the last decade. I think we're seeing a sort of similar thing now where, again, you know, Tottenham, Man City being drawn against together is not ideal, but it means that you'll definitely have an English team in the semi-final. And I think the other games for those English teams, Liverpool, I think, have Porto. So without wishing to do a disservice to Porto, I think they will feel confident about getting past that one, especially having beaten them last year on their route to the final. So, yeah, I'd be very surprised if an English team didn't manage to make it to the final, just when you look at the possible permutations in terms of how they would get there.
Interesting. You know, I need to see Juve there. So I believe the path, if I'm not mistaken, is Juve plays Ajax and then they get the winner of City Spurs.
Correct.
Yep. Okay. So Chris, in your opinion, who do you see in that semifinal? Do you see a City Juventus final? Do you think Ajax or Spurs can pull the upset in that?
I think Spurs will struggle to. I don't want to say that he's got Pochettino's card, but I think he works well against him. I think there's just something about Spurs I can't quite put my confidence behind. I think, look, it would be tremendous to watch as a neutral to watch Ajax continue that dream journey through, because we look back to them winning it in the mid 90s and it was impressive then. It would be even more impressive now. I don't think it's as, say, home-raid or young as that vibrant team in the 90s, but with the presence of De Jong and De Ligt, you've still got easily enough there to keep that sort of thread alive. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem I've got is that looking at that Juventus team against Atletico Madrid, centre-backs, Godin and Jimenez, they're arguably one of, if not the best, centre-back pairings in Europe. And realistically, in that second leg in Turin, Juve just killed them with crosses. Mm. And you have to wonder, looking at the teams that are left, is that potentially Juventus' route to the final and potentially even winning the thing? Is that if Godin and Jimenez can't stop Ronaldo in the air, can anybody stop Ronaldo in the air? It's a different way for them to play. They kept changing between a back three and a back four. I think Emre Can talked about that mm-hmm. it was very interchangeable, it was very flexible. And you put those two factors together and you think, well, how does any team stop that? I think one of the beauties of the Ajax result against Real Madrid, without wishing to diminish it, was that they caught Madrid at a really good time, because it was a club that is, I think, not in turmoil, but it's in transition, if nothing else. It's the wheels have definitely run dry on that one, because they've reached the peak of their powers. You know, a lot of players that are at the wrong age, the wrong time, and the momentum and inertia that carried them through to three Champions Leagues has run out. So I think, for me personally, I'd be surprised if it's not Juventus, Man City, and then from there, it's an amazing one to try and predict, because Juve have got that defensive strength that could frustrate City, and then, like I say, at the other end of the field, they've got Ronaldo and a potentially new route to victory with those crossing from people like Cancelo.
Right, exactly. It certainly will be an interesting, you know, quarterfinals and semifinals when we get there. If you had to pin the title on one of the eight teams that are still left in the competition, who would it be for you?
I mean, the last team I picked was PSG, so this could be unfortunate.
Kiss of death. Then don't say Juve.
I think it will be one of Liverpool or City. I think the way that they're playing this season, those two, I think they will split the trophies. So I'm going to say to push, I think it would probably be more likely Liverpool than City. I think you look at City against Swansea, mm-hmm. they were very fortunate, I thought, to leave that game with a win. And I think just because they've dodged that punch doesn't mean that another one isn't coming around the corner for them.
Amazing. Yeah, great stuff. Before we let you go, where can we find you in the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at KHENEAGE. And soon enough, you'll find me in New York having a beer with Roberto, because he's now a big star.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure about New York? What about Newcastle?
Either or. All I know is you're a massive star in my part of the world now.
Well, oh my.
Well, if you guys have that pint in New York City, then I'm going to self-invite and I'll join you there as well. All right.
Love it.
Thanks. Great to catch up with you again, mate, and all the best, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And that was Chris Hennage. Great to catch up with him again. Let's jump into some of our other topics here tonight, Rob. I'll tell you what, let's do the matches that we wanted to talk about. Obviously, you know, let's go back to Peru Paraguay first. Let's do that one first. Because you're going to have a much better handle on that match than me. Although I did see, like I mentioned earlier, my heart was broken with, Christian Cueva, scoring the lone goal in the match, but I'd like your opinion and your thoughts on the match.
Yeah, just watching the game over there, I think it was really a performance that essentially was probably based more on possession more than actual chances being made. Obviously, I think Peru had much more of a style and a system that allowed them to really function and try to work well against Paraguay, whereas the Paraguay team under new manager Eduardo Berizzo was just trying to find their system. Obviously, his first game in charge. You know, I think you look at the difference, I think, especially in the first half, you know, Paraguay was running and putting pressure on Peru, where Peru was just playing well. The goal against Cueva, I think, was sensational. I think it was a wonderful team goal, having watched again the replay. And I think no goalkeeper in the world would have stopped. No credit to Fernandez, the goalkeeper. So, I mean, sorry, no harm to Fernandez. So it really was I think a good game. It was more tactical, I would say. Second half was much, much better from Paraguay. Unfortunately, could not get the best chances being made. Almirón didn't have his best night. Sanabria was a bit off as well. But I think one thing you have to say is that, you know, you look at how perhaps the defense was a bit more sustained and more straightened. That's one thing that I was impressed of. But I think it's early days, obviously. I think when you're with a new manager, many people love to do the whole thing of having to judge the manager as a whole after just one game, especially a game that just ended in 1-0 thanks to an early goal. So it's early to say what to happen. I mean, obviously, I think the team is playing much, much better and more pressured and more pace-wise and more passing possession-wise. I think that's what I enjoyed. But again, it's still early days. I think the game against Mexico is probably going to be one to really focus on more. And if they can get a good performance there, then that's something to take part of and really focus on. But like I said, it's still early days. Credit to Peru, obviously a team under Gareca that has been playing fantastically well now for 4 years. You know, obviously undergoing such a wonderful process. They look really good. They look really good, and I'm hopeful that they can essentially achieve something. I really like Cueva as well, but, you know, Farfan, Andy Carrillo, Yuri Reyna, Yotun, I mean, they all played exceptionally well that night, and credit to them and credit to the result that they got.
Yeah, you know, I want to add in there, if you go on to Twitter and you look up Luis Miguel Echegaray and look up his Twitter feed, there is a great replay of the goal and how Peru was able to move the ball around despite the pressure that Paraguay was putting on in the midfield to get to Cueva and to get that goal. And there was it highlighted the way that the team, the Peruvian side, worked off of the ball to make that goal happen. Because it's not only the ability to quick pass to break down a press that Paraguay was putting on them, which was pretty impressive, but at the same time, moving, getting them out of position, and then being able to execute those passes—it's a great replay. And I know he has it on his timeline. I also want to echo the same thing that you said about it being early days. You know, with the turmoil that the Paraguayan national team has had, you know, switching coaches midstream here, it certainly is something that throws a monkey wrench in all of the development that they could have been doing over the past 6 to 8 months. And to come out and really hold a Peruvian side—remember that went to the World Cup and despite losing their three matches, played really well, in my opinion. And they have a seasoned coach in Gareca. They have a seasoned team. This is a team that's very familiar with themselves. They've been playing in the same system. To come out and perform like that and really only lose a 1-0 result is, you know, is a credit to them. And it'll be interesting to see how they do perform against Mexico coming up, you know, sometime this week. Mexico looked very, very good, Rob. I'm going to tell you that right now. I saw a little bit of that match against Chile, and they look like when Mexico wanted to snap the light switch and turn it on, it got turned on, and they looked fantastic. So it's going to be a great test for the Paraguay team, not only to implement that pressing style again against a good Mexican side, but to see if maybe they can get like guys, like you said, like Sanabria, like Amiron, going so that maybe one of them nets a goal and see what the team does, maybe even with a lead, how they perform that way as well. Because these are pretty important matches to prepare them for the, you know, for the Copa America that's coming up soon. So, but a great, you know, a great night overall in New York. Let's look at the other match that we wanted to talk about tonight. And that is the U.S. Ecuador match. That was a match played, you know, on Thursday night. And the U.S. with a 1-0 victory over Ecuador in a, with the Giassi Zardes goal in the 81st minute on a deflection. Rob, I know you were, again, following the Paraguay national team, so I don't know that you got to see too much of this match because of all the things that you were involved with doing that. So for me, my takeaways from this match, you know, I got to listen to people talk about this match on Friday morning on the radio. And many people were impressed. They were encouraged. They were using these types of words to describe the U.S. performance. I thought it was terrible, Rob. I thought it was an awful performance. One, for me, Tyler Adams lining up as a right back, I think is insanity. I don't think you put him there. And you saw him for the first 15 minutes kind of be that defender and have a little bit of trouble with Caicedo on that side. You know, defending, he needed to get help a couple of times. And it's just not where Tyler Adams belongs on the pitch. If you know, for me, you know, if I'm looking at Berhalter, I'm saying to him, you've seen this kid play at Red Bull. You've seen the film on him and what he's been doing at Leipzig. He's more of a centralized player. He's not a wingback. He did get the chance to be a little more open and, you know, move around a little bit more, which was encouraging. But then, and people were like, oh, you know, well, Greg Berhalter likes to play some kind of joker type position. And Tyler Adams was that joker position. For me, I'm not making my right back a joker that is free to roam about the pitch. That is a pretty important defensive spot. And if you've got somebody that is really well skilled on that side attacking, you can't have that guy as your joker. So I think it's a poor setup to start, you know, granted that the U.S. team was trying that we, you know, this was the way it was described. The U.S. team was trying in this match. They were trying to do things. They were putting forth the effort. Ecuador looked like they weren't even interested in being in the country. Okay. And if you're the United States and you're playing against a side that is completely uninterested in playing this match and you only manage a 1-0 victory on an 81st minute goal that comes off of a deflection because the goalkeeper's out of place, shame on you. That's a terrible performance. That match should be 3-0, 4-0, 5-0 because the team on the other side is just not interested in playing. And you're talented enough.
What do you mean by not interested in playing, though? That's kind of hard.
They weren't. There was no attack. There was no inspiration. There was no ambition in the match for me out of Ecuador. Ecuador was 11 kids standing on a field. At least that's what I thought. And you talked, you listened to some of these pundits on the radios and on televisions, and they were kind of saying the same thing. There were just 11 guys standing out there. And for me, if that's the case, if you have 11 guys standing out there, you've got to do better than a 1-0 victory on a deflection, right? I can't see it any other way. That was my opinion of the performance. Now, the other thing that I hate is that at the national team level, it doesn't matter if it's Bruce Arena. It doesn't matter if it's Greg Berhalter. They keep wanting to move Christian Pulisic centrally. They keep wanting to line him up centrally. He's not that player. If you go watch the film at Dortmund, he's not that player. When Chelsea brings him in, the discussion is not about him being a number 10. The discussion is him taking Willian's place on the right side. It's all about right wing play for Christian Pulisic, where he is most dangerous, where he is most effective, being able to cut in, being able to use his speed down the wings. And for some reason, at the national team level, they insist on making this kid line up centrally. And it drives me absolutely bonkers, Rob. I don't know if you saw that part or what your opinion is of...
No, I didn't see it.
Okay. But your opinion, I mean, but I know you've seen in the past that them constantly line up Pulisic centrally. And what's your opinion of that?
That's not his position. He's an eight. You know, he's not a... That's not his position. He works better on the flanks. And that's something that he's been, I guess, demonstrated at Dortmund. And I think should be noticed on the national team. I mean, that's That's all I could say. He doesn't play. He doesn't work well as a central, player.
I couldn't agree more. He's got, like you said, he's got to be out wide. He's got to be on the flank. He's got to be where he can be most effective in terms of, you know, driving the play. And I think that's, you know, when we're not putting him out there, then that's a big issue for me. So let's, you know, I'm just looking up here. The next match for them is going to be Tuesday night against Chile at 8 o'clock. So we'll have to see how they do it. Again, Chile was, you know, took the full force brunt of Mexico on Friday night. So going to be interesting to see how Chile bounced back again. And a side that's getting older in Chile, but a side that is still quite talented. And I think going to be a good test for the Americans moving forward. And I don't think we put them both in the plan, but at 5 o'clock is going to be Paraguay, Mexico, 8 o'clock, USA, Chile. So mm-hmm. on Tuesday night, it's going to be an interesting night for both of us. So, one more story that we wanted to talk about real quick, Rob, and that was, the reports that came out about a week ago that FIFA was looking to expand to a 48 team World Cup for 2022. Now there is a committee that's been put in place. This is based on the meetings that happened in Miami a couple of weeks ago. And there's been a meeting to possibly have the field expanded a tournament sooner. This is already going to happen in 2026 when the World Cup comes to the United States, Mexico, and Canada. But now they're talking about doing it in Qatar. There's a lot of issues. One, Qatar is barely prepared to host a 32-team World Cup, let alone a 48-team World Cup. So they're going to have to get help from other neighboring nations. The problem is that Middle East region is full of strife, right? So there are political implications here where the Qataris won't be able to host with another nation that borders them because of political tension. So this all feels like a huge money grab by Infantino to expand to a much larger World Cup sooner than expected. To bring more teams in, to lengthen the tournament, a tournament that's already going to jumble the schedule for FIFA or for the Europeans, for all of world football, for club football. It's a massive money grab for me. And in the end, I think it becomes dangerous to the players that are going to be involved because they're going to come off of their club seasons to go to this and then to go back to their club seasons in such short turnaround time that it really makes it difficult for them. What are your thoughts, Rob, on the expansion?
Yeah, I personally don't think it makes any sense. I think if you are going to expand it, you're going to have to do it in three countries, which obviously is a foreshadowing of Mexico, USA, and Canada. Being able to contain that many players, fans, people that are involved with the team during the span of a month. So I think it's ridiculous. Personally, I wouldn't be surprised considering it's FIFA and looking at it, as you mentioned, a money grab by Infantino. I would not be 100% surprised. I think there has to be some sort of pressure from some people. But yeah, it's unfortunately it's the more of the same, sadly.
Yeah, I agree. And we'll see. Again, this is in its infancy, the idea of it happening, and they're looking at the feasibility of doing this or expanding this field before the 2022 World Cup. They're going to meet again, I believe, if I remember correctly, in June to decide after they do some exploration on this. My gut feeling, Rob, is that it doesn't happen because it is just way too close to make any necessary changes, stadium expansions, security, transportation. There are so many moving parts that they would have to reinvent in such short notice that I just don't see it happening overall. So I think they will stick to it, but I think obviously the writing's on the wall. We're going to see a 48-team World Cup in 2026, and that will be the new norm moving forward. That will have a much more expanded side, but I don't see it happening this time around. I think there's just, and honestly, Rob, part of the inability to expand this for me is going to be on the fact that the World Cup's in Qatar, because of the political implications that happen between in the region. I think if the U.S. would have won this 2022 World Cup, and obviously go ahead and read a book. There's tons of why it didn't happen. But if the U.S. had won this and all of a sudden they were having this meeting and said, hey, we want to expand the U.S. 2022 World Cup to 48 teams, I think it's a much, much easier proposition. And I think they would have been able to do it. I think it would have made complete sense. And I think FIFA's short-sightedness with the money, with the personal money grabs that have been well documented for this 2022 World Cup, are now going to come back and bite them because they're not going to be able to expand the tournament as soon as they would like to. So, and I think, to be honest with you, Rob, there are very few places in the world that can hold a 48-team World Cup, right?
Right.
And then, and there are even less that can hold a 48-team World Cup, 48-team World Cup with 3 years' notice. So I think it definitely won't happen. So let's get back into the trivia. Oh, actually, you know what? Before we do the trivia question, Rob, let's go over some matches coming up this week. You know, we did mention the Tuesday matches, 5 o'clock for Mexico Paraguay, 8 o'clock for the U.S. Chile. Keep an eye on those on Tuesday. Also on Tuesday, we have some Euro qualifiers. We have Switzerland Denmark's going to be played Tuesday at 3:45 p.m. Copa Libertadores actually returns, Rob, on Wednesday night with a match between Cruzeiro and Deportivo Lara Wednesday night 8:30 p.m. In the Bundesliga on Saturday, we'll go back to club football on the weekend. Dortmund-Wolfsburg, a massive match there, 10:30 a.m. It'll be interesting to see if Dortmund can keep pace with Bayern Munich, who have made a mad rush to the top of the table. In La Liga on Saturday, 11:15 a.m., we have the Catalan Derby. Barcelona-Espanyol will be played. On Sunday, we have a slew of matches as well. Roma-Napoli will kick everything off at 9 a.m. In Ligue 1, we have Monaco-Caen at 9 a.m. as well. That's a relegation battle there, but Monaco have kind of moved themselves out of the relegation zone in recent weeks. And then we move to England with a big one, Liverpool-Tottenham Hotspur. We talked about this with Chris Hennage, the implications of Liverpool and some of these matches that mirror City and Liverpool. This is one of them. Sunday, 11:30 a.m., that's going to definitely be a must-watch. And we're going to close out the night and the weekend in MLS with Orlando DC United, Sunday at 6:30 p.m. Rob, I know it's early in the season, but DC United have not even conceded a goal yet in this season.
That's incredible.
Seven goals, four, no goals against. One question that I wanted to get out to Chris, and I didn't get it out in time. You know, I wanted to ask him more about his MLS champion. And I know you and I have pegged LAFC as our champions in the early parts of the season, but this DC United team, they've really done something special so far, don't you think?
They have. I think with players like Acosta and Rooney trying to click it well, it's really helped them moving forward. So, yeah, it's early days, obviously. So, but it looks good. They look great, and yeah. I hope that they can continue their run of form towards the later parts of the season.
Boy, don't you think DC United's real happy that the Luciano Acosta transfer to PSG didn't happen?
Yeah, probably would have been different for PSG.
Massive stuff there. So let's go back to the trivia question, Rob. And I gave it to you earlier. Moise Keane, at 19 years, 23 days old, became the second youngest scorer in the history of the Italian national team. Who was the youngest? I know it's a tough one. It's a really hard question because it's been almost, I think it was 50 years in the making.
Oh, hell no. I'm not going to make it.
So,
the player I was actually thinking of, I was thinking Del Piero because he's just been so there. He's been there for so long, but I don't think it's him. Well, obviously now, because if it's 50 years, it's definitely not him.
So I will give you the five youngest. Okay.
Okay.
Number five, a name you're certainly going to recognize, Giuseppe Meazza, 19 years, 170 days old. Yes. Number four, Carlo Rampini, 19 years, 166 days old. Number three, 19 years and 106 days old, Gianni Rivera. Moise Keane comes in at 19 years and 23 days. And number one, he's of Juve fame for the most part, but did spend some time at Padova, Roma, Sampdoria as well. Bruno Nicole, 18 years, 258 days old. He scored, believe it or not, Robin, this is an amazing, when I was doing the research on this question, because I was interested because I knew that Moise Keane was going to be one of the top two or three youngest ones. I did a little, looking up of Bruno Nicole. He only scored two goals for the Italian national team. Okay. But he scored those goals. He played eight matches, scored two goals, scored them both in the same match, a 2-2 friendly against France at the Parc des Princes in November of 1958.
Yeah, I just saw this as well. He also has the record of being the youngest ever captain for the Italian national team at 21.
And that's another one too that I wanted to bring up. I had a very successful career with Juventus from 1957 to 63, scored 47 goals in 141 matches, and has been known to be able to, to play multiple positions up top, whether it was a central striker or a winger, according to his bio that I read. So some interesting stuff. But I thought it was really cool that he's the youngest goal scorer. He scored 2 goals in that match, and it's the only 2 goals he scored for the Italian national team. So
you know that reminds me of, I think you obviously know who this guy is. Remember Lilian Thuram?
Of course I do.
Yeah, I think he's played multiple times with France, but I think he's only scored 2 goals in his career, and those 2 goals were a brace against Croatia in the semifinal of the 98 World Cup.
Massive.
So that's kind of what it remembers me of, like someone who's only scored 2 goals in their international career, and to do it at the same game. That just reminded me of Turan.
No, absolutely. That very cool stuff. So, all right, man, we've got nothing else left on the plan. So let's hit the closing music.
Let's do it.
All right, man. And as this fires up, just want to make mention to everybody listening that next week we are off and we will be returning to the airwaves on April 8th. So for episode 238 of Low Limit Football, special thanks again to Chris Hennage for joining us. We are off next week. Make sure you catch the Champions League matchups, which we'll discuss coming up in the next show. You'll also have the first set of Euro qualifiers done, and we'll take a look back at the friendlies as well. So for episode 238 of Low Limit Football, I am Joe Uccello.
I'm Roberto Rojas.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and good night.